This morning's Bible reading is from John's Gospel, chapter 5, verses 1 through 8. Hear these words of God. After this, there was a festival of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, there is a pool called in Hebrew Bethesda, which has five porticos. In these lay many invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been ill for 38 years, and when Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had been there for a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I'm making my way, someone else steps down ahead of me." Jesus said to him, "Stand up, take your mat, and walk." These are God's words for God's people. Praise be to God.
His students was a rabbi, Edwin Friedman. And Friedman began to look at churches and organizations and how we all, as any human system, is a system, and that all the interrelatedness is part of it, and about how we function as part of the systems that are around us. I mean, sometimes we feel victimized, don't we, about the stuff that goes on in our offices or in our homes, like things are out of control. This series is designed to help us to look closely at who we are and about our relationships and how we can be healthier at both. Now, a caveat before we begin. As you listen to this series, you are going to be very tempted to think, boy, am I glad they're talking about somebody else. This is about you as much as it is about the people around you. So keep that in mind as we go through this series. To use this series, we're going to use a technique that Jesus certainly used when he preached, and that was parables. Edwin Friedman, to illustrate some of these points, wrote a series of fables, and we're going to use some of those over the course of these next 5 weeks. It really is an opportunity for us to kind of think in different ways. Parables give us open-ended ideas and ways of thinking. So I hope that you'll want to be part of this. If you miss a week, I want to encourage you to find those sermons on our website, tlumc.org, because these are important. They kind of build on one another as we go through this process. So we're going to start with our first story, our first parable this week, probably the foundational one. If you get this, the other ones begin to make more sense. This one is called The Bridge. Okay, you ready? There was once a man who had given much thought to what he wanted from his life. He'd experienced many moods and trials. He'd experimented with different ways of living, and he had his share of both success and failure. At last, though, he began to see clearly where it is that he wanted to go. Diligently, he searched for the right opportunity. Sometimes he came close, only to be pushed away. Often, he applied all of his strength and imagination, only to find the path hopelessly blocked. And then at last, it came. But the opportunity would not wait. If it were seen that he was not committed, the opportunity wouldn't come again. Eager to arrive, he started out on his journey. He hurried along, and he came to a bridge that crossed through the middle of a town. It had been built high over a river in order to protect the town from the floods of spring. He started across. Then he noticed someone coming from the opposite direction. Only two of them there on the bridge. As they moved closer, it seemed that the other was coming to greet him. He could see clearly, however, that he didn't know this other person who was dressed similarly, except that he had something attached to his waist. When they were within hailing distance, he could see that what the other had attached to his waist was a rope. It was wrapped around him, and if extended, that rope would probably reach a length of about 30 feet. So the other began to uncoil the rope just as they were coming close. The stranger stopped him and said, "Pardon me, would you be so kind as to hold the end of this rope for a moment?" So our hero, surprised by this politely phrased but curious request, agreed. And without a thought, he reached out and took the end of the rope. "Thank you," said the other. Now two hands and hold tight." Whereupon the stranger jumped off the bridge. Quickly, the free-falling body hurtled the distance of the rope's length, and from the bridge, the man felt the pull instinctively. It pulled him right to the side of the bridge, right to the railing. He held tight and was almost dragged over the side. He managed to brace himself against the edge, however, and after he caught his breath, he looked down at the other, who was now dangling there close to oblivion. "What are you trying to do?" he yelled. "Just hold tight," yelled the one dangling off the bridge. "This is ridiculous," said the man, who began trying to haul the other back up. He couldn't get the leverage, however. It was as though the rope was cut to be the exact length to provide a perfect counterweight. "Why did you do this?" he yells down. "Remember," said the other, "if you let go, I will die." "But I can't pull you up," the man cried. "I am your responsibility," said the man dangling at the bottom. "Well, I didn't ask for it," said the man on the bridge. "If you let go, I'm lost," said the other. Well, our hero began to look around for help. He shouted, but there was no one within hailing distance. And the last two services, people tried to use cell phones for this. There is no help, okay? There's no help available. He thought, maybe I can tie it off onto something on the bridge, but the railing was smooth. There was no place to relieve himself of the burden, no way to get rid of it. "What do you want?" he asked the other hanging there. "Just your help," the other answered. "How can I help? I can't pull you in, and there's no place to tie the rope so that I can find someone to help me help you." "I know. Just hang on. That will be enough. Tie the rope around your waist. It'll be a lot easier." Fearing that his arms could not hold out much longer, he tied the rope around his waist. "Why did you do this?" he asked again. "Don't you see what you've done? What possible purpose could you have in mind?" "Just remember," said the one dangling there, "my life is in your hands." What should he do? He thought to himself, "If I let go all my life, I will know that I let this other one die. If I stay, I risk losing my momentum toward my own long sought after salvation. Either way, this is going to haunt me forever." Then he had another thought, an ironic thought. He thought, "Maybe I should just jump off the bridge myself and end us both. That would make everything right. That would teach this fool." But he wanted to live life and live it fully. "What a choice I have to make," he thought to himself. "How shall I ever decide?" What would you do? Talk to your neighbor about that for a minute. What would you do? As you're speaking, physics problems will not help you. Physics problems will not help you. Okay. What are the choices here? Let go? Or hold on? Is there another choice? Maybe. No, there's no physics problem. No physics problem. How many of you would hold on, continue to hold on? How many of you would let go? The rest of you are still trying to figure it out. There's got to be some way. There's got to be some way. Well, are there more than two? Are there more than two options here? One of the key issues that we face, and this is a parable about responsibility. One of the key issues that we face is the role we play in our relationship to others. The story of the bridge is a story about responsibility. For whom am I really responsible? That's the question. For some of us hearing this story, the issue is really how to make the man who is hanging off the bridge take responsibility for himself. Now, connect this to your own life. If you're a parent or you lead an organization, one of the things we are taught is that motivation is a key task in getting others to do what's necessary. Most leadership theory is based on this thinking. How do we motivate the unmotivated? Now, some of us will want to use charisma, the sheer force of personality, our persuasiveness, to motivate the other. Hundreds of books are published each year. You go to Barnes & Noble, and you look at the leadership section, and all of them say about the same thing. All of them are techniques on how to be a better parent or better leader, ways to motivate and manipulate children or subordinates. Somehow we figure if we could just push the right buttons, people would fall into line. I want some. Was in a church where the staff parish committee recommended that I go to a Dale Carnegie course. Any Dale Carnegie graduates here? They said, you really need to learn how to be nicer to people. So we're sending you to Dale Carnegie. It's true. It's true. They tried. They really did. So they sent me to Dale Carnegie. I mean, if you've done Dale Carnegie, you know that Dale Carnegie is really about how to get people to do what you want them to do. Right? You push the right buttons, you say the right thing, you say their name back to them a lot, you use different techniques. You know, primarily it's a public speaking course. I walked away with the award, by the way. You know, the gold, the acrylic cube, I won it. So it didn't really do what they intended it to do, but I smoked the course. It was awesome. So, and that's because this is all about, it's all about how do I get people to do what I want them to do? It's a little bit manipulative. We think if we can just push the right buttons, we can get people to do what we want them to do. Even governments are based on this kind of thinking. If we just have the right incentives, the right stimulus, the right this and that, people will do what we want them to do. Well, the flip side of that is consensus. Trying to get everyone to be on the same page. Making everybody happy to some degree. The will of the group becomes paramount. Motivation is supposed to happen because there is peace. Well, peace is elusive. Biblically speaking, the word peace, shalom, isn't the absence of conflict. It's about justice. Charisma and consensus are both strategies for motivating the unmotivated. We're used to them, but the problem is they rarely work in the long term. Think about it. On the charismatic side, if you're a charismatic leader, if you're a charismatic parent, if you're a highly responsible, over-functioning parent or leader, all the responsibility falls on you. And the more you function and attempt to motivate, the less motivation there is for everyone else in the system to be responsible. I mean, if you're going to do it, why should I? Right? The man hanging off the bridge relies solely on the character of our hero who is holding the rope. As long as he is functioning, the dangler doesn't have to. He just hangs there. And interestingly, what happens in that kind of system is that the least motivated are the ones who are really calling the shots and sucking up all the energy in the system. Who has the power on the bridge? The one hanging. The one who is needy. The one who is in need of help. Think about it. When someone in your home or your office is continually in crisis, always needing help, the attention and energy always goes right to them. Like the man at the pool in the gospel lesson. We read that a few weeks ago. Joe preached on it beautifully. And I wanted to bring it back because it's such a powerful story. There are those people, like that man at the pool, like our hanger-on here, who are in perpetual states of neediness. And they drain the energy of those around them. They always need someone to lead them to the pool, someone to haul them back up. But when they get there, they'll find another excuse, another problem. You never really fix it. Like our dangler in the story, they spend all their time yelling, "Help me!" And the reality is that the more we try to help by doing what they want, the less effective that help can be. On the consensus side, on the other hand, the responsibility is given to the group, which, left to its own devices and without clear leadership, tends to keep things in status quo. In consensus thinking, leadership is seen as merely enabling the group. Everything is counterbalanced, like the two men on the bridge. When the primary motivation becomes the preservation of the status quo, no one gets anywhere and the situation becomes stuck. On some level, we like the idea of peace in a family or group, but peace rarely, if ever, leads to progress. Vision rarely comes as part of a group process, for example. I love the old adage, "For God so loved the world, he didn't send a committee," right? Here's one of the basic tenets behind systems theory. You cannot motivate the unmotivated. You cannot do it. You can't make someone else responsible. No amount of nagging or threats or cajoling will truly motivate the unmotivated, whether it's a child, a coworker, or a parent. Like our hero on the bridge, there are situations in which no amount of reasoning will work. And some of you are nodding your heads because you know exactly what I'm talking about. I have tried everything. Here's the truth. And if you miss everything else in this sermon series, catch this truth. Here it is. The only person you can ever make responsible is you. Say that with me. The only person you can ever make responsible is you. The honest truth is this. The only person you can ever make responsible is you. The only way to help others be responsible is to focus on being responsible for yourself, knowing where you end and the other begins. The term for this is self-differentiation, learning how to define yourself, defining who you are and what you believe is more important than spending time telling people what is good for them or what they want to hear. To put another way, if you really want to change your family or your organization, that change begins with you. This became very personal to me. I was once serving a church that was, it put the capital D in dysfunction. Let's put it that way, okay? It was Dysfunction Junction, and it was crazy. You know, you get anonymous notes in your mailbox, for example, people writing nasty stuff about you. Although I heard a great solution about that the other day. I heard about a pastor who got a nasty note from a parishioner, and he sent it back in an envelope with another note that said, "I thought you should know, some idiot is sending out letters with your signature on them," and sent them back to the person. I thought that was classic. Very differentiated response. But that's the kind of church it was. You know, there was just a lot of junk going on all the time. And you've probably worked in places like that. Maybe you are in a place like that right now. And I was furious. I was upset. I was this close to quitting. I mean, yeah, I want to serve God, but I don't have to put up with this. So I went to a counselor as a last-ditch effort. And I went and I told her everything. I told her, these people are idiots. I can't believe what they're doing. They're just crazy. You know, there's stuff going on all the time. Anyone? Anyone? If that's God, tell them about half done. It was frustrating. And I went in and I spoke with her. And she listened to me the way counselors do. You know how counselors do. Oh, yes. Oh, that's awful. After 45 minutes, she said, "Okay, now let's talk about you." And that changed everything. She said, "You can't change this system. The only thing you can change is you and how you react, how you work in this world." The term for that is self-differentiation, learning how to define yourself. That's where she started me on, changed everything for me. But it sounds counterintuitive, doesn't it? But we're actually wired this way, to be differentiated. Consider your own physiology, for example. What is the purpose of your brain? Anyone? Thinking? Program the body? Good. That's actually the right answer. The primary function of your brain is not thinking. That's sort of a secondary process, as many of us know, right? Me included, right? Yeah. I told my wife, I said, you know, if I could use all the hard drive space in my brain that was filled with lyrics of songs from the 1980s and trivia, I could be Albert Einstein. You know, that's one of those things. We don't use that much of our brain for thinking. What do we use most of it for? Preserving the body, maintaining the health of the body. That's the basics. The brain thinks objectively. It senses danger. It moves the body from place to place, all focused on preserving the body. The brain tells the body, for example, that it's not good to jump off a bridge or to cross the street in front of a speeding bus. The brain is differentiated from the rest of the body, but is connected to it. Scientifically, we know that as our head goes, so goes our health. I mean, think about it. If our brain is focused on stress and worry, the rest of the body will begin to react with all kinds of physical ailments. Conversely, if our brain is focused on who we are and what we believe and what's important, the body will tend to be more healthy. I will tell you, in 20 years of ministry and visiting people in hospitals, the people who get well are usually the people who have the best attitude. When you give up, your body follows. The key to a healthy family or organization that is not focusing on the body or the other, but focusing on the head, yourself. If the head is healthy, the body will follow suit. I think that Jesus understood this better than anyone who ever lived. He is very self-differentiated, and he does not give his energy over to the anxiety of others who circle around him. And everywhere he goes, there is anxiety. There is anxiety with the Pharisees. There's anxiety with his disciples. There's anxiety with the people he goes and eats with. There's anxiety with those people on the hill who are eating with him. You know, those 5,000 he feeds, they're anxious. And when he feeds them, they want to make him king. What does he do? He walks away. He doesn't take their rope. The man at the pool of Bethesda has been needy most of his life. Notice how Jesus approaches him. He doesn't say, "Here, let me make you feel better." Or, "How can I help you?" What's he ask? "Do you want to be made well?" Where's the responsibility go? To the man lying on the ground. Do you want to be made well? The question of responsibility is put on the one who's in need. Are you willing to take responsibility for your own health? The man responds not with a yes or a no, but as needy people do, with excuses. "I can't get down in the water. No one will help me. Needy, needy, needy." Now we would say that the caring thing to do would be to make sure that this guy gets to the front of the line, right? We take responsibility for his pain, but not Jesus. What does Jesus say to him? "Get up! Get up!" He sounds like one of my old drill sergeants here. You know, "Sergeant, my foot hurts. I think I broke something." "Well, you got another foot. Get on it. Let's go." Right? "Get up! Pick up your mat and walk." Jesus doesn't take on his stress, his neediness, but he defines himself and makes everyone he comes in contact with just a bit more healthy. "Get up. You can do this." He made people responsible by being responsible for himself. "Go and sin no more," he says to those he heals. He shifted the whole human system because he was able to define who he was and what he believed, and nothing could shake him from that path. He knew what he was about, and he helped others get healthy by being so. I mean, what made the disciples after Jesus' ascension go on and carry on this mission? It's because he had taught them that no matter what, stick to what you believe. You help others best by defining who you are and helping them define who they are as well. If you see your family or your organization as being dysfunctional, the person you need to be looking at is you. How are you contributing to the dysfunction? How are you becoming enmeshed in all this stuff of others? How much energy and power are you giving to the unmotivated? When have you stated in a non-anxious way what you believe and acted according to that rather than according to the perceived needs of others? The big question is this: how will you get across the bridge? Back to our story. As time went by, still no one came. The critical moment of decision was drawing near. To show his commitment to his own goals, he would have to continue the journey now. But what a terrible choice to have to make. But a new thought occurred to him. A third option. While he could not pull this other one up solely by his own efforts, if the other would shorten the rope from his own end by curling it around his waist again and again, together they could do it. Actually, the other could do it by himself as long as he, standing on the bridge, kept things still and steady. "Now listen," he shouted down, "I think I know how to save you." And he explained the plan. But the other wasn't interested. "You mean you won't help? I told you I can't pull myself up, and I don't think I can hang on either. You must try. If you fail, I die." The point of decision arrived. What should he do? My life or this other's? And then the idea, a revelation. So new, in fact, it seemed heretical to him at the time. So alien was it to the traditional way of thinking. So he shouted down this. I want you to pay attention to what I have to say, because I mean what I'm about to say. I will not accept the position of choice for your life, only for my own. The position of choice for your own life, I hereby give back to you. What do you mean? The other asked. I mean, simply, it's up to you. You decide which way this ends. I will become the counterweight. You do the pulling and bring yourself up. I will even tug a little from here. And he unwrapped the rope from around his waist to begin to pull. You cannot mean what you say, said the dangler. You would not be so selfish. I am your responsibility. What could be so important that you would let someone else die? Do not do this to me. He waited a moment. There was no change in the tension of the rope. I accept your choice, said the man on the bridge, and freed his hands. Some of you here today have been holding on to ropes for a long time. A rope someone has given you. You find yourself stuck there on a bridge, trying to move on with your life while trying to motivate the unmotivated. You keep having that argument all the time. You might be a parent who's nagging and cajoling, haven't motivated that underachieving teenager. You're at the end of your rope. You might be a manager who has employees who are constantly in crisis. You're at the end of your rope. You might be a child whose divorced parents have you in a tug of war, each telling you how much they need you over and against the other parent. You're at the end of your rope. Or maybe, just maybe, you've been the one handing out ropes, giving responsibility for your life over to someone else. Your salvation and life are dependent on the unsuspecting others around you. And you might be sitting there thinking, well, none of this applies to me. Well, here's the thing. I guarantee you that sometime, somewhere, and soon, someone is going to come along and quietly hand you a rope. Probably when things are going well. That's one of Friedman's principles. When things are going well, watch out. What will you do? Now, don't misunderstand me here. The issue here is not detaching ourselves from everyone around us and by contrast, actually throwing others off the bridge. We don't do that. Self-differentiation doesn't mean that we ignore the needs of others. After all, we're a church, right? We're in a helping profession. But we only really learn to truly help others when we learn to define ourselves and when we help others learn to take responsibility for themselves. This is the basic building block of family systems. And we'll get into this more in this series of fables. What it comes down to is really a simple matter of using your head, knowing where your responsibility ends and where the others begins. To be clear about who you are, to be clear about what it is you believe, to define yourself. There are consequences for every action, good and bad, but unless we begin to operate in a self-defined way, we will always be stuck on a bridge in a pointless effort to try to motivate the unmotivated. It's counterintuitive. But what would happen if you learned to let go? What would happen if you gave responsibility back to the hangers-on in your life? What would happen if you asked the question of others, or especially of yourself? Do you want to get well? Do you want to be made well? It begins with you. Let's pray together. Lord God, Jesus defined for us what it meant to be a self-defined person. One who helped others, but helped them take responsibility for their own lives. He helped them become less needy by becoming whole. Teach us his way. Open our hearts and minds to a new and radical way of thinking. In the name of Christ, amen.